This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek. It's Friday, it's World Cancer Day today, and it's also our Doctor in the House segment. So many dates we're commemorating, actually. We are still in the midst of Chinese New Year celebrations, but we do want to also mark something very important, which is World Cancer Day. But joining me today, as always, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee. How are you, George?
I'm very good. I am sure many listeners out there will say, "Are you pantang lah?" You know, taka laisi, right? You know, Chinese New Year talk about cancer. But the good thing is that we really need to kind of like get rid of this taboo about cancer, right? Because obviously, cancer prevention is what we're aiming for. Even though Chinese New Year, we're talking about research and how do we prevent cancer. And then I would like to highlight something. You know, Lee Hsien Loong, when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, he specifically chose the second day of Chinese New Year to have his operation. So, you know, if Lee Hsien Loong doesn't feel so pantang about it, we shouldn't feel so pantang about Chinese New Year and talk about a very important subject like cancer.
Yeah, and I thought that it would be good to have a positive look in our discussion about cancer, not looking at it, like you said, like a taboo subject, but looking at hope, looking at potential, looking at the future. And who better, right, to help share some perspectives on this than Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang, Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia, where they have been doing such amazing and groundbreaking work. Hi, Prof. Teo. Happy Chinese New Year. Kong Hei Fa Choi.
Kong Hei Fa Choi, Xiao Ying. Happy New Year, George. Nice to see both of you.
And do you agree with George's outlook, you know, that we want to change the way we talk about and frame cancer?
Absolutely. You know, 50 years ago, one in four cancer patients survived the disease, and it's invariable that people think of cancer equals to death. But then today, a lot more people are surviving the disease, and we really need to push forward and think about it as hope. Because if we are able to do that, you know, the first step is really changing mindsets. If we always think about cancer as doom and gloom and hide behind the shadows, we'll never really find out the facts and we won't know more about the progress. And we won't focus our intention on making it much better for patients in the future, right? Mm.
If we say 50 years ago, was that survival or?
Yes, one in four cancer patients survived the disease. Today, it's two in four. And we think that within the next, hopefully, you know, we won't take us another 50 years to get a survival for all cancers to be three in four. But, you know, you can think about diseases like breast cancer, for example. Breast cancer is already, you know, in many countries, 9 out of 10 women already survive 10 years. For prostate cancer, that's also true. In many countries, 9 out of 10 patients survive 10 years. So, you know, for some diseases like testicular cancer, it's almost 100% cure rate. So the challenge is really, you know, not to focus on the 2 in 4 today that survive the disease, but how do we make sure that every cancer is like breast cancer, prostate cancer, and testicular cancer with almost 100% survival rate?
I mean, Soo Hwang, I really agree with what you said, that the survival is improving. I think part of the reason why survival is improving, obviously, is scientific research and also new technology, new drugs. But I really hope that less taboo, people actually present earlier. That will be one of the challenges that we face to make the survival rate even better. What do you say about that?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, George. You know, the harsh reality is that because we think of cancer as a death sentence, when someone is diagnosed, we sometimes think of alternatives. You know, what do we do as alternatives? And maybe the treatment won't work. We don't have a lot of trust and faith in the... And that leads to delays and poor adherence, and that results in poorer survival. So we have a gap in meeting survival because of the lack of understanding of the advances in therapy. And you're absolutely right. The area that it's actually making the most impact is because we don't talk about cancer. We don't know what needs to happen in early detection and early presentation and early treatment. There's so many missed opportunities of saving lives. So in a sense, you could say that the future is now. We're not actually talking about a future where personalized medicine and individualized treatment is possible. That future is already here. The challenge is making sure that everyone understands this future is here and can engage with it in a way that enables us to quickly transform outcomes for cancer patients.
Shoei, I think there's another challenge that in Asia, it's uniquely Asia that we face. It's like, you know, we have all these conventional, traditional Chinese medicine, and that sometimes hold up the patients presented earlier because, you know, the neighbors always recommended something about, like, you know, some herbs, you know, somewhere from, you know, some sort of like a orchard somewhere. And I really hope with knowledge, that sort of delay will be minimized. What do you think?
Absolutely agree. You know, there is a lot of value in some of these complementary medicines. Traditional Chinese medicine, traditional Ayurvedic medicine, and so on, may have beneficial effects on our health, including in our body systems and in our immune systems. But their strength in fighting full-blown disease, particularly cancer, is less well documented, particularly on it, if you take it alone without any of the conventional methods that we already know can cure cancer. You know, such advances are possible because of surgery, that with robotic surgery, with more advanced surgery, with early detection of cancers, many of these are curable. With advances in radiotherapy and chemotherapy, many cancers are today curable. But if patients delay because of trying other things, no, they think that, oh, I'll just use surgery or chemotherapy or radiotherapy as a last resort. That thinking needs to change because the result of that resulting delay would mean that we have poorer outcomes. And that's true. You know, Asia has currently got poorer outcomes than the rest of the world. And it's an atrocity. We shouldn't be here.
So, you know, World Cancer Day this year is embarking on a new 3-year campaign, and the theme is Close the Care Gap. So if we have already dived right into deep end by talking about early detection and, you know, screening and things like that for prevention as being one of the gaps, what do you think are the other kinds of gaps that we need to close?
I think the key is to, you know, the main theme for the UICC or the World Cancer Campaign is really to focus on the fact that today, 70% of the deaths due to cancer occur in low and middle income countries. And by the year 2030, up to 85% of the deaths due to cancer will occur in low and middle income countries. And even in high income countries, poor people are less likely to get the disease, but more likely to die of the disease. This is not correct. There's absolutely a care gap, and we really need to make sure that we can bring all of the technological advances that are possible to detect cancer early through screening, to treat cancers more affordably through targeted therapy, immunotherapy, advanced surgery, and so on. All of these advances in technology are made available so that we can make sure that there are more affordable solutions and new ways to deliver healthcare to the most vulnerable populations. That is a very major challenge for the entire world.
So basically, if you can't afford it, you are not likely to survive.
If you can't afford it, isn't that terrible? That you can't, that the survival is possible, but we're robbing people of a mother, of a father at a time that they might need it the most. Because in many countries in Asia, the median age for cancers is younger than what it is in high-income countries. You know, in high-income countries, the median age might be in your 70s and so on. And at that age, you know, life is still is important, but you may have less dependence. But if you are affected by cancer in your 40s and your 50s, you have many dependents, not only your children, but to some extent also your parents. And if you are not able to survive the disease, who will take care? The repercussions on the extended family is major. And we really need to make sure that we can deliver better care to put people back into the community so that they can continue to be with their families and lead go back to a normal life, one that they are working and being part of their family.
I mean, this is a sad fact, right? Many people can't afford to be ill, leave alone can't afford to have cancer. I mean, it's easier said than done. We want to close the gap, but it's almost impossible to do even in a first world country. How do we achieve it?
I'm an optimist, George. You need to be an optimist if you're ever going to be a scientist. I think we always need to look at the glass, you know, as in there are infinite possibilities. And I'm really encouraged by the fact that we're starting to use technologies in new ways that hopefully will reduce the cost. I'm optimistic with using better data science, using AI potentially, could potentially democratize access to services in ways that was not possible before. So for example, you know, in the past, we only talk about teleconsultation when you can get a doctor to kind of read an image in that's coming maybe from a remote center that doesn't have the specialty to be able to diagnose the disease. But that was a one-to-one relationship. You basically needed a doctor on the other end of the line to look at that image and call what it is, right? But with the use of artificial intelligence, perhaps this kind of access to diagnosis and accurate diagnosis could become more available even in places where there isn't enough specialists. And through the technological advances, who knows, maybe we will be able to create, you know, handheld devices that enable us to bring early detection to remote locations. Mobile phone apps like the ones that we're developing hopefully will enable early detection of oral cancer and visible cancers and so on. And I think that we need to make sure that we focus on just not just applying technology to push the frontiers of science, but apply technology to bridge the gap that exists between the rich and the poor.
Let's go for a quick break now. And when we come back, I want to find out more about the work that Cancer Research Malaysia is doing to close that gap. Joining me today, my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee, and our guest, Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, Chief Scientific Officer at Cancer Research Malaysia. And we're discussing how we can close the care gap this World Cancer Day. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. It is Friday and it's time for our Doctor in House series with my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee. It is also World Cancer Day today, so we are commemorating it together with Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, Chief Scientific Officer at Cancer Research Malaysia. Now, before the break, Prof. Teo had already shed some light on the gaps that exist in cancer care when it comes to prevention and screening, but also in terms of accessibility to life-saving treatments and medications, especially this gap between higher and lower income countries. Now, let's turn to what Cancer Research Malaysia can do within that space. First of all, it would be interesting to give our listeners a glimpse behind the curtain, so to speak, Prof. Teo. I mean, cancer is such a vast area, right? I mean, how do you and your team decide on which areas you want to prioritize in terms of research?
Xiaoyik, you're absolutely right. You know, in Malaysia, we're still a small country and the amount of funding that we have, which is funded entirely by donations, is still quite small. So we have to be able to focus on the areas that we can make an impact. So we chose to focus on hope. We chose to focus on us, which is that Asians are left out in the world of cancer research. And as George rightly points out, without research, there can be no advances. So basically, because Asians are underrepresented, all of the advances, you know, much of the advances may miss us. Now, don't get this wrong. I'm not saying that many of the treatments that have been developed in Europe and North America don't work in Asian populations. Hardly. They do work in the Asian population in the main. But there are subtle differences that we don't know enough about unless we do the research. So, for example, some cancers are just more common here. If we don't do the research for these, they will remain cancers that simply have poor outcomes and the outcomes continue to be poor 50 years on. For other common cancers, you know, cancers like breast cancer that's affected by genes and our diet and our microbiome, unless we study how are these in the Asian population affecting our risk to disease and our response to treatment, we're not going to be improved survival. And finally, as George pointed out, we have such quaint beliefs, you know, a lot of our beliefs around life, particularly during Chinese New Year, we see it very evidently, circle around food, right? So our food is different, our diets are different, our microbiomes, the bugs that live in our guts are different. All of these influence our behaviors, and we really need to be able to study all of those. And finally, George also pointed this out, how we treat the healthcare system, you know, how we use complementary medicines, traditional medicines, how we need to be educated and how do we do shared decision-making are cultural things that we need to do research on. And all of this research can lead to a better outcome for Asian patients. And that's what we're focusing on, doing the impactful research in Asians to benefit our population, to ensure that advances can be brought to bear to help our own population.
Shall we ask, you know, how did you pick a specific pathology? And I think that one thing that sometimes I have a bone to pick with you is that I realize that Cancer Research Malaysia has done fantastic work and published extensively in first-tier journal when it comes to breast cancer. So I think there's a bit of cancer equity problems here, because on my side, I feel like it's very lopsided towards female gender. So I think that at some point, you know, with all that template that you built, all the scientists and expertise that you built, I really think that Cancer Research Malaysia can expand beyond that and then focus a lot more on, you know, obviously common cancers, a lot more like colon cancers and prostate cancers.
Is that absolutely right, George? You know, this is a bone that a lot of patients take with me, particularly the men. They say, oh, Prof, you're sexist. You only work on female cancers, you know, with an extensive program in breast cancer and, you know, ovarian cancer, as well as in head and neck cancers. Why don't you have a program in prostate cancer and in colorectal cancer and even in lung cancer? The honest truth, George, is that we would love to do so. But I have challenges. There are three key challenges. Number one, and they sound like excuses, and I wish I could change the outlook, but at the moment, I have my hands tied because of three things. Number one, there's simply not enough researchers in this country. That's a sad truth. It's hard to be a researcher. It's hard to be able to train and retain people in this field. And, you know, we really need people to come forward and consider this as a career. And hopefully the fact that Malaysians have been able to publish in New England Journal of Medicine, in Journal of Clinical Oncology, in Nature and so on, this encourages Malaysians that we're not just doing backyard research that doesn't matter, but we're actually doing impactful research that's on a global stage. It can be done. We know how to do it. We just hopefully have more people coming forward that have an interest in that area. Number two is, it's research like what we've done in breast cancer. It's only been possible because the tissue samples have been possible to accrue. So it's been possible to collect the tissue samples. And, you know, I have really got Professor Datuk Dr. Yip Cheng Ha, Professor Dr. Nur Aisyah, as well as pathologists in University of Malaya and SGMC and a whole team who have been collecting tissue samples, and it's only because of those tissue samples we're able to do research. I would love to be able to do that in prostate cancer. But the prostate is unfortunately one where the surgical cases are such that we just simply don't have enough tissue samples to collect to do that type of research. And finally, I think the key stumbling block is money. Ultimately, it's just about the money. We do not have the funding that's necessary to do this work. I would really love to be able to do that. And hopefully, before I retire, and that day seems to be looming, but before I retire, it would be really wonderful to be able to do more work in prostate cancer, in colorectal cancer, and particularly in lung cancer and nasopharyngeal cancer. So watch this space. I know I've been saying it for some time, watch this space, but the pandemic has really derailed our program, and hopefully we can really reinvigorate it with the support of the public.
I don't want you to retire anytime soon, Prof. And, you know, George, I would challenge you to use your vast networks to, you know, help out cancer research with their funding problems. But I mean, there was another point that I wanted to bring up. How has funding been disrupted for CRM?
Yeah, it's been difficult. You know, 2020 and 2021 were our best years ever in science, right? In terms of the discoveries, the output, the fact that we've gone into clinical trial, the fact that we've licensed our vaccine, we're moving towards phase one clinical trial with our vaccine. We've already started treating patients with immunotherapy for metastatic breast cancer. It's an amazing year for both of those years have been amazing in terms of science. But the harsh reality is that because of the economic climate, the pie for charitable funding has shrunk. And the needs for charitable funding has just gone up astronomically. You know, with so many people losing their jobs, needing computers for their children as they transition to online learning, needing more computers as they transition to work from home, needing, you know, office chairs at home, you know, simple things like that, to floods, dealing with floods and the devastation that we saw. And those are really incredibly urgent needs. You know, sometimes in life, we have to accept that, you know, we would like to focus on the things which are urgent and important, like cancer research and investing in a better future. But there's just times in our lives where urgent things override everything else, no matter how important. And I'm really worried about whether cancer research will you know, all of the progress that we made, whether we can sustain it. And unfortunately, this continues to be a bit precarious. George does what he can. He was fantastic in always attending at our events and doing webinars and endless things with us, you know, which is really fantastic. But we need more George, you know, and more like you, Xiaoyik, and the partnership with BFM are fantastic in raising awareness.
Talk to us about this vaccine that you mentioned. You know, the idea of a cancer vaccine is still quite new in people's minds, right? I think we can only think of maybe HPV, a vaccine for cervical cancer. Tell us more about what you're working on.
So other than surgery, radiotherapy and chemotherapy, I believe that the biggest breakthrough is going to be immunotherapy. So we've known for a really long time that in order for cancer cells to grow, they need to evade the immune system. They need to pretend that they are not a foreign entity and they need to be destroyed, right? So they need to find a way to dodge the immune system. And so what has been really exciting and, you know, the subject of a Nobel Prize and so on has been the development of a new way of activating the immune system to recognize cancer cells. You know, just 10 years ago, less than 1% of cancer patients would potentially benefit from immunotherapy. But recently, a published paper shows that up to 45% of cancer patients in the US could benefit from immunotherapy. But the challenge is that only 12% of those patients would actually respond to immunotherapy. So 45% of patients could benefit from immunotherapy, but today, only 12% of them actually have any possible response. So the challenge has to be, how do you make immunotherapy more, have such a durable response in more patients? And that's what our vaccine does. Our vaccine trains immune cells to go into the location of the location of the tumor itself. So in a sense, tumor cells have found a way, some tumor cells have found a way to get the immune cells out of the tumor and not actually within the vicinity. So even if you can unveil the magic cloak that keeps the cancer cells invisible, there's no immune cells anywhere close by to attack those. So our vaccine essentially targets the specific proteins that are found in cancer cells, enabling the immune cells to now go to within the reach of the tumor cells. And when used in combination with some other forms of immunotherapy, appears to have close to a 95% percentage of tumor control. So we're hugely excited about these, but unfortunately, the data is currently only in animal studies. What we need to do is take this into human trials, and we're very optimistic. If everything goes well, we've passed the first round of safety studies. Second round, hopefully, has been delayed, but hopefully we'll finish by Q3 of this year. Everything goes well, we hope to be able to launch our first phase clinical trial by the end of this year or early part of next year. Imagine that, a therapy that was developed right here in Malaysia going into clinical trials for a cancer that is common in this part of the world.
Which cancer would it work for?
This will be for oral cancer and nasopharyngeal cancer at the first instance, two cancers where 75% of the incidence and 75% of the deaths due to these cancers are in Asia. But we've already not stopped there. We're already starting to test whether this vaccine will also work in other cancers, such as lung cancer, nasopharyngeal cancer, and liver cancer. And the reason why we think that it might work is because, you know, just like the COVID vaccine targets the spike protein of the coronavirus, our vaccine targets a cancer protein that is also found in other tumors. So hopefully we can test whether our vaccine could also boost the immune system in these other cancers. So that's Akan Data, on the works.
And so then you could potentially get that 45%, you know, almost half of patients benefiting from immunotherapy. Is that right?
Not quite right. We don't know yet. I think the challenge, you know, the reason why cancer is so difficult to handle is because, you know, it is not one disease. There are 200 different types of diseases all under this umbrella of cancer. You know, five of those cancers make up nearly 50% of all incidents, right? But the reality is that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, I think in treating cancer, we need to get across this concept of individualized treatment. Precision medicine is not just about being able to have more precise tools to treat cancers, but knowing for which patients they benefit from which therapy. And George knows all about this in his clinic because he's never treated any patient all as the same thing, right? All patients are different because you need to consider their characteristics and the characteristics of their tumor to choose the right treatment for the right patient at the right time.
You know, George, you are advocating, you're lobbying for more research locally to be done on prostate cancer, for instance. Prof. Teo has talked to us about certain cancers that CRM is working on, and we've spoken to her in the past about so many of their groundbreaking research. What would you like to see for prostate cancer?
Well, we all know prostate cancer behaves very differently. I mean, we heard this terminology saying that, you know, most people die with prostate cancer rather than die of prostate cancer. One of the challenges that we face as clinicians is that how do they differentiate between the tiger and the pussycat, right? The tigers are the one who's really going to kill you. The only things we have at the moment is a bit kind of like old data of LVs Gleason scoring, basically looking at the differentiations of the cells and then trying to predict these cell, kind of like cellular progression. However, what I really like what Suhan was saying about is that you use the big data in order to analyze the whole progression. Basically, you want to be a step ahead of the cancers in order to look at its natural progression. And then the only way, which I'm really, really guilty of, is actually having the data. Because what Cancer Research Malaysia has been done so successfully with breast cancer is because they have got really large network of clinicians who really contributed all these tissues. And the patients, of course, the patients in the other end were willing to donate their tissue so that it can be analyzed into the big picture and she can almost come up with algorithm. But in my side, I'm really guilty of really not presenting that data because even in Malaysia, our cancer registry is really not contributed fully by clinician because it's not mandatory for you to fill it in. And we're all very guilty of not having enough time, not putting enough energy in order to contribute to the big picture. So you hit the nail on the head there. I'm guilty of two things, not really contributing towards all those data that we have because they are very valuable. And the secondly, really not contributing enough to find out how many patients die, how many patients get the diagnosis, and what's your progression. And from there, we really will get very valuable information.
I think, George, you're being a bit too hard on yourself. You know, I think it's amazing that you put a voice and a face to prostate cancer. And I think the prostate cancer campaigns, you know, with Dato' Sri Nazira Razak are really important because it highlights the importance of early detection of prostate cancer, right? I would really love to be able to tag a research study onto that so that all of the men who are coming forward for a PSA test are then enrolled into a national research study that we follow up for a long time. And the purpose of that follow-up is to try and understand, okay, can we, for example, the low-hanging fruit is to ask all of these men, do you have someone in your family who has breast cancer, who has ovarian cancer? Because that's number one predictor of being at elevated risk of having developed the tiger type of prostate cancer and not the pussycat type of prostate cancer, right? Just having a family member with breast and ovarian cancer or pancreatic cancer even is already a predictor. So we would love to be able to just work it out in the cohort and work out, can we get these men with these characteristics to come forward to really have closer monitoring so that we can identify the tiger cancers in them before they really are too advanced. And then at the same time, we would really like to be able to look at some of the biomarkers that have already started to be developed but haven't been validated in the Asian population. And the natural history of disease does have some differences between populations. It's critical that we really examine this in the Asian population.
Well, there you go. I mean, I hope we've built a bridge today or that we can continue to do that this year when it comes to prostate cancer. Now, we do have to go for another quick break and we'll continue our discussion about closing the cancer care gap in conjunction with World Cancer Day today with my co-host, Dr. George Lee, and our guest, Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, Chief Scientific Officer, Cancer Research Malaysia. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. Joining me, my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee, and our guest for today, Chief Scientific Officer at Cancer Research Malaysia, Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang. We are talking about the role of research in closing gaps when it comes to prevention and treatment of cancer. And the reason we're discussing this today is, of course, today, the 4th of February is World Cancer Day. Now, let's talk a little bit about ovarian cancer, Prof. Teo. Your team recently published a study about genetic counseling for ovarian cancer. Could you share a little bit more about that?
Ovarian cancer is not as common as breast cancer or prostate cancer, and it's not even as common as cervical cancer, you know, which is another common female cancer, right? But it's of the female cancers, it's the most lethal. And part of the reason is because it's a silent disease. There's no good tool for screening. There's no good tool for early detection. And as a consequence, the world over, 70% of ovarian cancers present at late stage. This is an atrocity because at early stage, you know, early stage, stage one ovarian cancer is almost 100%, nearly 95% curable. So how do we stage shift? The only way that we can stage shift at the moment is if we can identify the individuals that are at higher risk of ovarian cancer, and we make sure that we can offer them preventative strategies such as removing your ovaries after you finish having children. It is a day surgery that's is laparoscopic surgery, very straightforward, very minimal side effects to the women, especially after they've had children, and that could significantly reduce their risk of cancer. You know, in an Asian population, it's not unusual for women to have hysterectomies, and sometimes to have salpingo-oophorectomies is also not unusual. But to be able to remove the tubes, the fallopian tubes, could be an important prevention strategy for ovarian cancer. So like I said, because ovarian cancer, A, not very preventable, possible to screen for the disease, it's important to know what the risk is. And so our challenge has been to deliver genetic testing to the ovarian cancer patients as well as to the breast cancer patients so that if we can identify the BRCA carriers and enable the family members to know their status, you know, within 10 years, there's a study in the US that suggests that if we do this systematically for breast cancer and ovarian cancer patients, within 10 years, all the families that have a genetic alteration could potentially know their status, and they could all have benefit from prevention and early detection programs. And that by doing that, we could potentially reduce the number of breast cancer cases by 5% and reduce the number of ovarian cancer cases by 13 to 15%. Isn't that a future that we should really work towards, making sure that people at high risk have access to genetic counseling and genetic testing?
So what did your research find in terms of mainstreaming that access?
Yeah, so what we found was that today doctors are not comfortable talking about genetics. You ask, you know, someone like George is perfect at talking about genetics, but the majority of doctors out there are not trained and not comfortable talking about genetics. Now, if you're the primary care provider and you're trying to, you know, deal with the patient's treatment and so on, you don't talk about genetics, in reality, the patient will never want to find out about genetics. So what we did in the study, you know, if you are going to just refer on to a different clinic, a genetics clinic, nobody turns up. So what we did in this study was we trained oncologists, we trained gynae oncologists, surgeons, to provide the genetic information. They did it initially in 45 minutes and completely screwed up their clinics, and they all got hopping mad with us. So I have 40 patients outside. I had to spend 45 minutes with this one patient. But doctors being doctors, they're all wonderful. And within a few patients, they got down their counseling session to less than 5 minutes. So somewhere between 5 to 7 minutes, they could really deliver the essence of genetic counseling and testing. And by doing that, by training the doctors to enable them to do that, we found that rather than only 2% of ovarian cancer patients having access to genetics, it went up to 60%. And this was a national program that was across 23 hospitals. So our goal is to try and replicate that in breast cancer setting, and that's a new study that we'll be launching this year.
You make it sound very, very, I won't say easy, but very achievable. Is that your optimism talking?
Absolutely not. To be really honest, I think my husband will tell you I'm the most pessimistic person in town. I always look at all of the potential problems because I always look at, and I'm a worrier at heart. But we have achieved so much with so little. And I think the reality is that we kind of need to look back on what we've been able to do in the last 5 years alone. And a lot of what we're doing is now not just making an impact on the scientific front, but actually taking a lot of the tools that we've developed into the clinic, be it a vaccine, a new Asian risk calculator, new genetic counseling modules, new clinical trials, new patient navigation programs, and so on. All of these are going into the clinic and changing the healthcare system. So I have to stop being a worrier and really look at it and say, you know, we are making the future be real today. We just need to continue on this path. And I'm confident that we will really make progress.
I mean, Suwan, you mentioned this, the words that you achieve so little, you know, so much with so little. I think that goes without saying that everyone knows that, you know, ranging from recruiting the scientists, publications, fundraising, and also patient counseling, genetic counseling. And then you are like, you know, you're taking on everything. My only worry, and as you know that I'm a big supporter for Cancer Research Malaysia, my only is that we only have one Teo Su Huang. We don't have many other more. We can't clone you. And then early on, you started talking about retiring. And then the second thing is that the current situation, because obviously you can achieve all that with a lot more funding. And then, you know, how sustainable is the current form of funding? And then maybe one of the ways that we can talk about is that any other more innovative way of getting more money into your pockets?
Yeah. Thank you, George. I think you've covered quite a lot on there. And the first point is really whether it's been possible to clone me. I will hope that it's not possible to clone me, because I think my husband already finds it difficult to deal with one of me. It would be terrible if there was one, and that we ever impose that on any other man out there. So let's try and keep it to one. But the reality is that there are many other junior scientists who may not be as outspoken and may not have had the opportunity to be able to be in the public eye. And I think that's it. They haven't had the opportunity to be in the public eye. I'm really only the spokesperson and the mouthpiece. There are a lot of talented Malaysians out there. And I think if there's one key message that Cancer Research Malaysia has demonstrated, it is that Malaysians are talented, and we shouldn't really just look at Malaysians overseas, but try and support Malaysians who are here. Be proud of the Malaysians who are here and are trying to make a difference here. Be it the scientists, the people who are talking about communicating what we do, the people who are taking care of our accounts, the people who are sweeping the floor and taking care of our labs, all of these individuals are Malaysians that are dedicated to a cause and a belief that we can make a difference. So I think it's that team effort, and it's not just about me. I'm confident that even if I was to step away, the organization would really succeed, because there's a lot of strength, not just in the individuals, but the collaborations that we already have. I think the second part of what you say is that, you know, can we sustain ourselves? And to be really honest, I'm also optimistic on that front. And that's because, you know, we not only have corporate donors like Yayasan Sime Darby, Yayasan Petronas, that have kept us alive for so long, supporting our salaries and our overheads, but now we've actually successfully run a couple of public campaigns. You know, last year, 1,600 people went bald as part of the Bold and Beautiful campaign, and they raised 3 million ringgit, 2 million of which came to Cancer Research Malaysia. So the average amount for those donations are small. But what does this say? This means that if we're going out there to tell Malaysians, please fund us, this is all funded by donations. Your donations can make a difference. We're making progress. If we can inspire the average Malaysians to contribute, hopefully we can build a broader base of donors that enables this type of work to sustain year after year. Because the challenge now, you know, the challenge 20 years ago is Malaysians are cannot, scientists cannot, sure not. And the reality is, you know, I probably was of that group. We more used to doing things in Cambridge and Oxford and the rest. But I think we've proved that we can do this in Malaysia. We can make an impact when going into the clinic, we're benefiting patients. The challenge now is, can we raise the money? Can we sustain the organization and continue to do that? I'm optimistic. We have volunteers helping us. We have so many people coming to give us a pat on the back, and hopefully this will continue. Hopefully people will join our campaign and support the organization sustainably.
What keeps you going in cancer research, Prof. Teo?
People. ultimately, it's people, right? It's the, I think I have an enthusiastic team who, without a doubt, do this way beyond their call of duty. My concern is always at 10:30 at night, stop working. Can you just stop, switch off Teams now? And my concern is really about giving them the opportunity to succeed in ways that makes their journey easier than it was for me. It wasn't an easy journey for me. I hope they don't have to go through what I went through, because it's not so easy to do that. The second thing is really about patience. You know, we did a clinical trial with immunotherapy, and being able to interview two of the patients just this last weekend and hear their hopes, hear what they went through, and hear the fact that, you know, they thought they only had a few months, but because of the immunotherapy trial that they were on, they're now cancer-free for nearly a year. And knowing that, you know, despite the pain and the suffering that they have, they still come forward and do that interview with us because they hope that other people realize that this research is happening here. I think that really puts a fire in behind your back, right? To kind of really keep you going. And then hearing individuals who have nothing, they really don't have enough to come to the hospital, but seeing that our patient navigation program is able to provide them with the support that gives them the hope that cancer cures are not just for the rich, but also for them. And seeing their trust in the navigators and their hope that there's a just world out there, all of these things, the impact of what we do is just absolutely amazing. And hopefully we can continue to sustain this work.
Shelby, I am very, very honored that I had the privilege to moderate one or two sessions on webinar. The two things that I really could feel is, number one, is that the passion of the scientists and all the individuals in Cancer Research Malaysia. Without a doubt, I can verify that, you know, I probably can sense that you're working way beyond midnight. And then when they get very excited, they really don't stop talking about their work. The second thing that I felt really, really quite touched and heartfelt kind of like a feeling is that the people's the individuals, the family members who lost their loved ones or actually had their life affected by cancer, they really go in all out trying to make sure that every campaigns are successful. I really hope that we don't really need to wait until you're affected by a cancer or affecting member of your family to make that decision, because at the end of the day, it potentially can affect you anyway. Why don't you just join in and listen to what they do, and you really get quite mesmerized by what Cancer Research Malaysia do.
Is that what keeps you going, George? I mean, you are not just a physician. You advocate so much. You do so much education about cancer as well. What keeps you going?
Well, I really agree with you. I do ask myself, from time to time, what keeps me going? Why do I wake up every day and really looking forward to my work? And that's the only way that I can judge what keeps me going. I really think that is, it's about the passion of what you do, because trying to find solutions for people who face adversities in life, such as cancers, and how rewarding it is just to see you change your life. And that really is priceless.
I mean, the reality is that, you know, George and I are very privileged, right? The reality is we wake up, I don't know about you, George, but I wake up every day feeling very blessed. Blessed not just by the circumstances that I find myself in, but by the opportunity that we have to do good. And that is probably what keeps me going. Just the fact that opportunity has been given to me and to my team, and to our donors and to our volunteers, that opportunity, you know, enables us to make more of the life than the time that we have, right? And I think that's really a privilege, that it's an honor to be able to serve.
And if people want to find out how they can donate to or support Cancer Research Malaysia, where can they go?
Well, please go to our website, which is www.cancerresearch.my, and also follow us on Facebook. Apologize that our website is a little bit out of date, but please do also check out our blog. We have various articles on there that talk about the work that we do and so on. And it's moving at a really fast pace. So, you know, join us on Facebook and follow us.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. And again, a very happy Chinese New Year. To the both of you, my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia. This has been Health and Living BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.